You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Mystics After Modernism. And this, I'm going to read the preface to the 1923 edition and the introduction together in this first section. Preface to the 1923 edition. The intention of this work of more than 20 years ago was to answer the question, why did a certain form of mysticism clash with the beginning of modern scientific thought during the 13th to the 17th centuries? I had no intention of writing a history of the mysticism then, but to answer this specific question. Publications on this subject since the beginning of the 20th century do not, in my opinion, provide any basis for changing the answer. The work thus remains essentially unchanged. The mystics discussed here were the last representatives of a means of inquiry and thinking that in its details is alien to contemporary consciousness. But the soul attitude at the center of their methods of inquiry does exist in the nature of thoughtful people today. The way those of this soul disposition viewed natural phenomena before the period discussed here has almost disappeared. In its place is modern natural science. Those described in this book were unable to transmit that earlier method of inquiry into the future. It ceased to correspond to the cognitive forces that developed in Europeans after the 13th century. What Paracelsus or Jakob Boehme preserved through this kind of research seems to be merely a memory of a past impulse. It is mainly the disposition of soul that remains in thoughtful people. Such people look for an impulse in the soul's own inclinations, whereas before it arose in the soul while observing nature. Many of those inclined toward mysticism today have no desire to kindle mystical experiences in relation to what modern natural science teaches. Rather, they utilize the ideas from the works of that period. In this way, however, they alienate themselves from present trends. It might seem as though contemporary knowledge of nature in its true nature fails to reveal a way that the soul can find, through mystical contemplation, the light of spirit. Why are mystically inclined souls satisfied with Eckhart, Boehme, and others, but not with the book of nature, insofar as it has been opened by knowledge for us today? It is true that, as this book of nature is discussed today, it cannot, for the most part, lead to a mystical soul nature. This work tries to show that this kind of discussion is unnecessary. I have attempted to show this by speaking of those spirits who, in the soul mood of old mysticism, developed a way of thinking that can incorporate newer knowledge. Nicholas of Cusa was such a person. In such people it becomes apparent that modern natural science, too, has a capacity for mystical intensification. Nicholas of Cusa would be able to relate his thinking to this science. In his time, one could have discarded the old means of inquiry, while retaining the mystical disposition and accepting, had it existed, modern natural science. But if it is strong enough, whatever the human soul finds compatible with the way of inquiry, it must also be able to remove from it. I wanted to describe the characteristics of medieval mysticism to show how it developed into a mysticism independently of its native soil, the old way of conceiving things. It cannot preserve itself, however, because it now lacks the spiritual impulse that it had in earlier times through its connection with inquiry. This brings us to the thought that we must look for the aspects of more recent research that lead to mysticism. From this inquiry we can regain the spiritual impulse that does not stop at the darkly mystical and emotional inner life, but rises from mystical beginning to knowledge of spirits. Medieval mysticism atrophied because it lost the substratum of inquiry that directs the faculties of the soul upward to the spirit. This book tries to provide a stimulus for extracting the forces directed toward the spiritual world from more recent inquiry, when understood properly. Rudolf Steiner, Dornach, Switzerland, autumn 1923. Introduction: Mystics, Natural Science, and the Modern World. There are magic formulas that have continued to act in new ways throughout the history of ideas over the centuries. In Greece, one such formula, Know Thyself, was considered to be an oracle of Apollo. Such phrases seem to contain within them an infinite life. They may be encountered along the most diverse paths of spiritual life. As one advances and comes to understand all phenomena, the meaning of such formulas becomes deeper. There are times during our meditations and thoughts they flash like lightning, illuminating our whole inner life. At such times there arises in us the sense that we perceive the heartbeat of humanity's development. How intimate we feel with people of the past when one of their sayings reveals the feeling in us that they too have experienced such moments. We have the feeling that we are developing an intimate relationship with those individuals. We become intimately acquainted with Hegel, for example, when we encounter these words, quote, "One may say that such things are the abstractions we behold when we allow philosophers to dispute and quarrel and decide matters one way or another in our studies. They are abstractions, made of mere words. No, absolutely no. They are acts of universal spirit, and consequently of fate. In this way, philosophers are closer to the master than those who feed on crumbs of the spirit. They read or write the orders from on high, in the original. It is their function to take part in writing them. The philosophers of the mystics, who were present at the act in the innermost sanctuary, and who participated in it." Footnote from Lectures on the History of Philosophy, 1887. End of footnote. When Hegel said this, he experienced one of those moments I described. When he made these statements, he had reached the end of Greek philosophy in his historical analysis. Here, he showed that Neoplatonic wisdom, which he speaks of at this point, had been illuminated in him like a stroke of lightning. At the moment of that illumination, he became intimate with spirits such as Plotinus and Proclus, and we become intimate with him as we read his words. We also become intimate with the solitarily meditating vicar in Chopau, M. Valentinus Vigelius, Valentine Weigel, when we read his words, quote, "We read in the works of old sages the useful proverb, Know thyself, used primarily in reference to worldly behavior. For example, quote, look well at yourself, what you are, close quote. Quote, search in your heart, close quote. And, quote, judge yourself, do not censor others, close quote. Although, as I say, it is used in human life with respect to behavior, nevertheless, the saying, know thyself, may be well applied to both a natural and a supernatural understanding of humanity. People should look not only at themselves and think of how they should act toward others, but also understand their inner and outer nature, in spirit and nature, from which they come, are made of, and are intended for." Close quote. Footnote from his booklet titled Know Thyself, 1578, Valentine Weigel, 1553 to 1588, a mystical writer, developed Paracelsus and alchemical ideas. His ideas influenced Jakob Böhme and other German Protestant mystics of the 17th century. Most of his writings were published after his death, when a small group of Weigelians promoted his ideas, and some texts were issued in his name, pseudonymously. End of footnote. From his own points of view, Valentin Weigel thus arrived at insights that were summed up for him in the Oracle of Apollo. A similar road to understanding and the same position with respect to the proverb, "Know thyself," can be ascribed to a succession of penetrating spirits, beginning with Meister Eckhart and ending with Angelus Silesius, a group to which Valentin Weigel belongs. Common to these spirits is a strong feeling that a sun rises in human self-knowledge, illuminating something beyond the incidental, individual personality of the beholder. What Spinoza realized in the ethereal height of pure thought, that, quote, "the human soul has sufficient knowledge of the eternal, infinite nature of God," close quote, lived in them as direct perception. For them, self-knowledge is the path to this eternal and infinite nature. It was clear to them that self-knowledge, in its true form, endows human beings with a new sense. That sense opens a world to humanity that cannot be attained without this sense, just as the world of the physically sighted is unavailable to the blind. It would not be easy to find a better description of the importance of this new sense than that given by Fichte in his 1813 Berlin lectures. Quote, "Imagine a world of people who are born blind and know only the objects and their conditions that exist through touch. Go to them and speak of colors and other conditions that exist only for our eyes via the medium of light. What you say to them will be nothing, and it is better if they say so, because in this way you will soon see their mistake, and if you cannot open their eyes, it will end such useless talk. If, for some reason, they wish to give meaning to your teaching, they would be able to understand it only through their knowledge gained by touch. They will want to feel the light, colors, and other visible qualities. They will believe that they feel them, and within the realm of touch, will invent something they name color, and deceive themselves with it. They will then misunderstand and turn things around and misinterpret them." Close quote, footnote. Johann Gottlieb Fichte, 1762-1814, German philosopher and exponent of transcendental idealism, he emphasized self-activity of reason. Originally an ardent follower of Kant, he presented a, quote, "perfected," close quote, Kantian epistemology, in which he connected practical reason with pure reason. End of footnote. We could say something similar about the efforts of those discussed in this book. They viewed self-knowledge as the opening of a new sense. To them, this sense leads to insights that do not exist for those who do not perceive the nature of self-knowledge that differentiates it from all other kinds of knowing. Those to whom this sense is not accessible think that self-knowledge arises somewhat the same as knowledge does through the ordinary senses, or through some other external agent. To them, quote, "knowledge is knowledge," close quote. In the one case, however, the object is in the outer world, and in the other, within our souls. They hear only words, or at best, abstract thoughts, where those who look more deeply see the essence of inner life, namely in the dictum that the object is outside ourselves for all other kinds of knowing, whereas self-knowledge allows us to stand within the object, that every other object comes to us as complete and closed off, whereas within ourself we actively, creatively weave what we observe within. This explanation may seem like it is mere words, even trivia, but when understood properly, it can appear as a higher light that illuminates all other knowledge in a new way. Those who see this explanation as mere words are in the same position as the blind, to whom one might say, quote, There is a brilliant object. Close quote. Such a person hears the words, but the brilliance is non-existent. One can gather in oneself all of the knowledge of a period, but if one fails to perceive the significance of self-knowledge, all knowledge is blind in the higher sense. Independent of us, the world lives for us because it communicates itself to our spirit. What is communicated to us must be expressed in a language we understand. A book would be meaningless for us if its contents were to be presented in an unknown tongue. In the same way, the world would be meaningless if it did not speak to us in our own language. The same language that reaches us from the realm of objects, we also hear in ourselves. But then it is we who are speaking. It is only a matter of listening properly to the transformation that occurs when we close our perception to external objects and listen only to that which sounds within us. It is for this listening that the new sense is necessary. If it is not awakened, we think that in the communications about us, we perceive only communications about an object external to us. We are of the opinion that there is something hidden somewhere that speaks to us in the same way as do external objects. If we have the new sense, we know that its perceptions are quite different from those that refer to external objects. We know that this sense does not separate itself from that which it perceives, as the eye detaches itself from the object it sees, but that it can completely incorporate the object within itself. If I see an object, the object remains outside me. If I perceive myself, I come into my own perception. A person who looks for some part of the self outside of what is perceived shows that the essence of what is perceived has not become apparent. Johannes Tauler aptly expressed this truth, quote, "If I were a king and did not know it, I would not be a king." Close quote. Footnote, Johannes Tauler, 1300 to 1361, was a German mystic, preacher, and member of the Dominican order. He was expelled from Strasbourg and settled in Basel. He was largely influenced by Meister Eckhart and became one of the major mystics of the Rhineland. He stressed practical mysticism over speculation, and his sermons were highly regarded by Martin Luther. End of footnote. If I do not become clear to myself through self-perception, then I do not exist for myself. But when I become clear to myself, I possess myself through perception in my most fundamental nature. No part of me remains beyond my perception. Fichte strongly points to the difference between self-perception and all other kinds of perception. Quote, "It would be easier to convince most people to consider themselves a piece of lava on the moon than a self. Those who are not in agreement with their self in this sense will not understand any comprehensive philosophy, nor do they need one. Nature, whose machine they are, will lead them without their participation in everything they must do." To philosophize, one must be independent, and independence is granted only by oneself. We should not desire to see without eyes, but neither should we assert that it is only the eye that sees. And close quote. Footnote, J.G. Fichte, Grundlage der gesamten Wissenschaftslehre, Berlin, 1812-1813. End of footnote. To perceive oneself, therefore, means to awaken the self. Through knowing, we connect the nature of the object with our own nature. The communications bestowed by the outer world through our language become aspects of our self. What confronts me is no longer separate from me when I know it. the aspect of it that I can assimilate is incorporated into my own nature. When I awaken my own self, when I perceive what is within me, I also awaken to a higher existence, all that I have incorporated into my nature from outside. The light that falls on me as I awaken also falls on those things of the world that I have assimilated. A light flashes in me, and it illuminates me, and, with me, everything I know of the world. All that I know would remain blind knowledge if not for this light falling on it. I could penetrate the whole world with my knowledge, but it would not become what it must within me if knowledge is not awakened to a higher existence within me. What I add to things through awakening is not a new idea, and it does not enrich the meaning of my knowledge. Rather, it raises knowledge to a higher level that endows everything with new brilliance. As long as I do not raise my cognition to this level, in the higher sense, all knowledge remains worthless to me. Things exist without me, too. They contain their own being. What does it mean when I connect another spiritual existence that echoes things within me to the existence of what remains outside me? If it were merely a matter of repetition, this would be pointless. It is a matter of duplication only until I awaken the spirit of what I take into myself to a higher existence within me. When this happens, I have not reproduced the nature of something within me, but caused it to be reborn on a higher level. When I awaken myself, a spiritual rebirth of things in the world takes place. In that rebirth, things manifest qualities they had not possessed previously. There, outside, is a tree. I take it into my mind. I shine my inner light on what I have apprehended. Within me, that tree becomes more than it is externally. The part that enters through the portal of the senses is received into spirit. The tree's counterpart, as idea, is within me. This says infinitely more about the tree than the external tree can tell me. The tree's nature shines on it only from me. The tree is now no longer the isolated being it is in external space. It becomes a part of the spiritual world as a whole within me. It combines its meaning with other ideas in me. It becomes a part of the whole world of ideas that embraces the vegetable kingdom. It is further integrated into the evolutionary scale of every living thing. I could cite another example. Imagine, for example, that I throw a stone horizontally. It moves in an arched path, and after a while falls to the ground. In successive moments, I see it at different locations. After some reflection, I arrive at the conclusion that during its movement, the stone was subjected to various influences. If its only influence had been the impulse I gave to it, it would fly in a straight line forever, with no change in velocity. But the earth influences it as well, through attraction. If I had simply let go of the stone, without giving it an impulse, it would have fallen vertically to the earth. While falling, its velocity would have constantly increased. The reciprocal action of these two influences produces what I actually see. But what if I were unable to separate these two influences mentally and reconstruct what I see by combining them according to certain laws? The matter would remain only what was visible. That form of observation would be spiritually blind, merely a perception of the stone's successive positions. In fact, however, matters do not remain there. the whole process occurs twice. Once, outside where my eye sees it, EYE, then in my mind, which allows the whole process to repeat before my mind's eye, EYE. My inner sense must be directed toward the mental process, which is not seen by my eye, EYE, and must realize that I awaken the mental aspect of that process with my own forces. One can again cite a saying of Fichte that makes this clear, quote, "The new sense is the sense for the spirit. It is a sense for which only spirit exists and nothing else, for which the other, given existence, also assumes the manner of spirit, becoming transformed into it, and for which, as a result, existence in its own right has actually disappeared. This sense has been used for seeing as long as humankind has existed. Everything great and excellent in the world, and which alone makes humanity endure, originates in the visions of this sense. But it was not true that this sense saw itself as different from and in opposition to the other ordinary sense. Rather, the impressions of those two senses become fused, life split into these two halves, without a unifying bond." Close quote. That unifying bond is created because the inner sense perceives spirit, which it awakens through its communication with the spirituality of the outer world. Consequently, the aspect of things we take into our spirit no longer appears as a meaningless duplication. In contrast to what external perception can impart, it emerges as something new. The simple process of throwing a stone, as well as my perception of it, are seen in a higher light once I clarify the task of my inner sense for myself in this matter. To intellectually combine the two influences and their characteristic actions, I need all of the meaning I gained by perceiving the flying stone. Thus I use the mental meaning already stored within me when confronted by something in the external world. This process of the external world is integrated into the pre-existing meaning. In essence, this process reveals itself as an expression of this meaning. Through the comprehension of my inner sense, I can see the relationship between the meaning of this sense and things in the external world. Fichte could say that without comprehending this sense, the world splits into halves for me, things outside and their images within. Those halves are united when the inner sense understands itself and realizes the kind of light it shines on the outer world through cognition. Fichte could also say that this inner sense sees only spirit. It sees how spirit illuminates the sensory world by integrating it into the world of spirit. The inner sense allows external sensory existence to arise within it as a higher spiritual essence. An external object is completely known when there is no part of it that has not experienced a spiritual rebirth in this way. Every external thing is thus integrated with spiritual meaning, which, when comprehended by the inner sense, participates in the development of self-knowledge. The spirit of a thing enters the world of ideas completely through illumination from within, as does our own self. This explanation contains nothing that can be proved logically, nor is this necessary. It is simply a result of inner experiences. Those who deny its claim merely reveal that they lack such inner experience. It is pointless to dispute such a matter with them, just as it would be to dispute color with a blind person. One should not say, however, that such inner experience is possible only through the gifts of a chosen few. It is a quality common to everyone. Anyone who does not reject it can take the path to its attainment, but such rejection is not unusual. One always has the feeling, when encountering objections in this vein, that it is not a question of not being able to acquire inner experience, but a matter of blocking one's access to it with a multiplicity of logical chimeras. It is almost like looking through a telescope and seeing a new planet and still denying its existence because calculations do not indicate a planet in that particular location. At the same time, most people definitely feel that there is more to outer nature than is given through the ordinary senses and analysis. They think that everything else must also exist in the outer world, as do the objects of external perception themselves. All that should be apprehended with the inner sense, and on a higher level, that is, the object perceived and comprehended with the intellect, is displaced into the outside world, to be considered inaccessible and unknown. People speak of limits of knowledge that prevent us from knowing the, in quotes, thing in itself. People speak of the unknown essence of things and never acknowledge that this essence becomes clear when our inner sense lets its light fall upon them. An especially revealing example of the mistake buried in this attitude was furnished in 1876 by scientist Dubois-Raymond in his well-known speech Ignorabimus. Footnote: Émile Heinrich Dubois-Raymond, 1818-1896, German physiologist and professor in Berlin, known especially for his investigations of animal electricity, physiology of muscles and nerves, and metabolic processes. End of footnote. According to him, we should limit ourselves to seeing manifestations of, in quotes, matter in natural processes. We cannot know anything about the nature of matter itself. He asserts that we can never get to the point where matter haunts space. But the reason we cannot get to that point is because nothing at all can be found there. Those who agree with Dubois-Raymond think that any understanding of nature points to something else that understanding itself cannot provide. Dubois-Raymond does not, however, wish to take the path that leads to somewhere else, that is, to inner experience. Consequently, he is helpless when confronted by the problem of matter, as though it were a dark secret. For those who take the path of inner experience, phenomena is reborn. Whatever remains a mystery for outer experience becomes clear. Thus, inner human life lights up not only itself, but outer reality as well. From this perspective, an infinite vista opens before human knowledge. Within is the glow of a light whose luminosity is not confined to the interior. It is a sun that illuminates all of reality at once. Something appears within us that unites us with the world as a whole. We are no longer merely a single accidental person, no longer a particular individual. The whole world reveals itself within us and discloses its own interrelationships. It shows us how we as individuals are connected to it. Knowledge of the world is born from self-knowledge. Our own limited individuality assumes its spiritual place in the grand interconnected web of the world because something comes to life within us that reaches beyond our individuality and embraces everything in which our individuality participates. Thinking that does not use logical prejudices to block its own path to inner experience will always come to recognize the essential nature acting within us. This essential nature connects us with the whole world because through it we overcome the contrast of inner and outer in relation to ourselves. Paul Asmus, 1842 to 1876, a clear-sighted philosopher who died young, comments on this situation. Quote, "We can become clearer about this matter through an example. Imagine a piece of sugar. It is round, sweet, impenetrable, and so on. These are qualities we all understand. There is only one thing that seems to be completely different and beyond our understanding. It is so different from us that we cannot penetrate it without losing ourselves. Our thought timidly recoils from the mere surface of it. This one thing carries all these qualities and is unknown to us. It is the very essence that is the innermost self of that object. Hegel correctly says that the whole meaning of our idea is related to this unfathomable subject only coincidentally, and that we qualify this essence without really getting to the bottom of it. Since we do not know this essence itself, such qualifications ultimately have no real objective value, being only subjective. In comprehending thinking, however, we do not encounter an unknowable subject whose qualifications are only accidental. Rather, the objective subject falls within the concept. If I comprehend something, it is completely present in my concept. I am at home in the innermost sanctuary of its nature, not because it lacks its own essence, but because it compels me through the necessity of the concept, which appears subjectively in me and objectively in it, to rethink its concept. As Hegel says, this rethinking reveals to us that just as this is our subjective activity, it is at the same time the true nature of the object. Close quote, footnote, Paul Asmus, title Das Ich und das Ding an sich, the I and the thing in itself. Halle, 1873, end of footnote. Only those who can also illuminate the processes of thinking with the light of inner experience can speak in this way. Beginning from different points of view, entitled Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, I have also pointed to the primordial fact of the inner life. Quote, "Without a doubt, in thinking, we hold a corner of the world process where we must be present if anything is to occur. And this is exactly the point at issue. This is exactly why things stand over against me so puzzlingly, because I am so uninvolved in their creation. I simply find them present. But in the case of thinking, I know how it is done. That is why, for the contemplation of the whole cosmic process, there is no more primordial starting point than thinking." Close quote. Footnote from Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, A Philosophy of Freedom, page 41, end of footnote. For those who view inner experience in this way, the meaning of human knowledge within the context of the whole universal process is clear. It is not an unimportant supplement to the rest of the universal process. It would be unimportant, however, if it only reiterated, as ideas, external existence. But something that does not occur anywhere in the outer world takes place in understanding. That universal process is confronted with its own spiritual nature. The universal process would never be complete if that confrontation did not take place. With it, our inner experience is integrated into the objective universal process. It is evident that only a life dominated by the inner sense, our highest spiritual life in the truest sense, lifts us above ourselves. Only in this life is the nature of things revealed in facing itself. It is different for the lower faculties of perception. The eye, EYE, for example, mediates the perception of an object. It is the scene of a process that, in terms of the inner life, closely resembles any other outer process. My organs are part of the spatial world, like other things, and their perceptions are temporal processes, like others. And their nature becomes apparent only when submerged in inner experience. Consequently, I live a double life. I live the life of a thing among things. It exists in its corporeality, and through its organs perceives what exists outside that corporeality. And I live a higher life above this one. It knows of no inside and outside, and extends over both the external world and itself. I must therefore say that at one moment I am an individual, or limited I, and at another I am a universal I. That's capital I. This too Paul Asmus has put into appropriate words. Quote, "When we submerge ourselves in something else, we call it thinking. In thinking, the capital I has fulfilled its concept. It has surrendered its separate existence. Therefore, in thinking, we find ourselves in a realm that is the same for everyone. Because the principle of isolation, parenthesis, which is the nature of the relationship between the I and what is different from it, close parenthesis, has disappeared into the activity of the I, suspending the its separateness. There is only I-being common to all." Close quote. This is exactly what Spinoza has in mind when he stated that the highest activity of cognition proceeds, quote, "from an adequate idea of certain attributes of God to an adequate knowledge of the essence of things." Close quote. Footnote. Spinoza, title Ethics, Part 5, Proposition 25, close quote. Close footnote, end footnote. This advance is simply the illumination of things by the light of inner experience. Spinoza describes the life of this inner experience in glorious colors, quote, "The highest virtue of the mind is to know God, or to understand things by the third kind of knowledge. And this virtue is greater in proportion as the mind knows things more by the said kind of knowledge. Consequently, those who know things through this kind of knowledge pass to the summit of human perfection, and are therefore affected by the highest pleasure, such pleasure being accompanied by the idea of themselves and their own virtue. Thus from this kind of knowledge arises the highest possible acquiescence." Close quote. Those who comprehend things in this way transform themselves within, because at such moments the separate I is absorbed by the cosmic universal I. Cosmic beings do not manifest as subordinate to a separate limited individual. They appear to themselves. At this level there is no longer a difference between Plato and me. What separates us belongs to a lower level of cognition. We are separated only as individuals. Universal nature, acting in us, is one and the same. One cannot dispute this fact with a person who has not experienced it. Such a person will always insist that Plato and I are two. One cannot prove this dichotomy, that all multiplicity is reborn as unity in the development of the highest level of knowing. It must be experienced. Paradoxical as it may sound, it is true. The idea that Plato represented to himself, and the same idea that I represent to myself, are not two ideas. They are one and the same idea. These ideas do not exist separately, one in Plato's head and the other in mine. Instead, in a higher sense, Plato's head and mine interpenetrate, All heads that grasp the same single idea interpenetrate. This unique idea exists only once. It is there, and the heads all transport themselves to one and the same place to contain this idea. The transformation that takes place in the whole character of people when they adopt this view is shown beautifully in the Bhagavad Gita, the ancient Sanskrit epic. Wilhelm von Humboldt said that he thanked his destiny for allowing him to live long enough to become acquainted with this work. Footnote: Wilhelm von Humboldt, 1767 to 1835, was a German philologist and diplomat to Rome. He was a pioneer in ethno-linguistics, particularly in his study of the Basque language, which has no known affiliation with other languages. End of footnote. I will also mention that the Bhagavad Gita is on this website. End of aside. The Inner Light says in this poem, quote, "A portion, even of me, which, becoming an immortal living being in the world of living beings, draws together the senses with mind as the sixth existing in nature. When the Lord, the soul, acquires a body, and when it departs from it, it takes these senses and goes, like the wind taking sense from their receptacle. It presides over ear, eye, touch, taste, smell, and also the mind, and uses the objects of the senses. When it gets up or stays or enjoys in company with the constituents, the bewildered perceive it not. They who have the eye of knowledge perceive it." Close quote from the Bhagavad Gita, 15:7-10, E.J. Thomas, translator. End of footnote. So strongly does the Bhagavad Gita point to human transformation that it says of sages that they can no longer err or sin. If they seem to err, they must illuminate their thoughts or actions with a light in which what seems like sin to ordinary consciousness no longer appears as such. Quote, "One whose nature has not the thought of I, and whose intellect is not stained, even though one slays all these worlds, slays not, nor is bound." Close quote, Ibid. 18:17. This indicates the same basic disposition of the soul, springing from the highest cognition. Spinoza, after describing it in his title Ethics, pours out these captivating words. Quote, "I have thus completed all I wish to set forth, touching the mind's power over the emotions and the mind's freedom. Whence it appears, how potent are the wise, and how much they surpass the ignorant, who are driven only by lusts. For the ignorant are not only distracted in various ways by external causes, without ever gaining the true acquiescence of their spirit, but moreover live, as it were, unaware of themselves, God, and things. And as soon as they cease to suffer, they cease also to be. Whereas the wise, in so far as they are regarded as such, are scarcely disturbed at all in spirit, but being conscious of themselves, God, and things, through a certain eternal necessity, never cease to be, but always possesses true acquiescence of spirit. If the way I have pointed out as leading to this result seems exceedingly hard, it may nevertheless be discovered. It must be hard, since it is so seldom found. If salvation were readily available and could be found without great labor, how could it possibly be neglected by almost everyone? All things excellent, however, are as difficult as they are rare. Ethics, Part 5, Proposition 42. Close quote. Goethe outlined the perspective of the highest knowledge most significantly. Quote, "If I know my relationship to self and the outer world, I call it truth. Thus everyone can have their own truth, and it remains the same truth." Close quote from Verses in Prose. Everyone has their own truth, because each person is an individual, distinct being compared with others. Let me read that again. Everyone has their own truth because each person is an individual, distinct being compared with others. Those other beings act upon the individual through the organs. From a particular point of view, where one is placed, and according to the nature of that person's faculty of perception, one's own truth develops through communication with things. An individual achieves a relationship to things. Then, when one attains self-knowledge, coming to know one's relationship to self, the particular truth dissolves into the general truth, and this general truth is the same for everyone. Those who possess a deeper nature view an understanding of the suspension of the individual in a personality, suspending one's capital I in favor of the universal I, to be the primordial mystery of life revealed within the human being. Goethe also found an apt expression for this, quote, "And so long you that do not have this, die and become. You are only a cloudy guest on dark earth," close quote, from Blessed Longing. What takes place in the human inner life is not a mental reiteration, but an actual part of the universal process. The world would not be what it is if it were not active in the human soul. And if one calls the highest attainment of the human being the divine, then one must also say that the divine is not something external to be recapitulated as an image in the human spirit. Rather, one must say that the divine is awakened within the human being. Angelus Silesius found an appropriate way of saying this, quote, "I know that without me God cannot live for a moment. If I come to nothing, he must give up the ghost," close quote. He goes on to say, quote, "God cannot make a single worm without me. It would immediately fall apart if I did not preserve it with him," close quote. Footnote from The Cherubinic Wanderer, Volume 1, Verses 8 and 96, and a footnote. Such an assertion can come only from one who suggests that there is something in the human being that is needed for the existence of an external being. If all that belongs to the, in quotes, worm could exist without the human being, it could not be said that the worm would fall apart without the human being to preserve it. In self-knowledge, the innermost core of the world comes to life with spiritual meaning. For the human being, the experience of self-knowledge means acting within the core of the world. Those who are imbued with self-knowledge also naturally conduct their own actions in the light of self-knowledge. Typically, human action is determined by motives. It was stated correctly by the poet and philosopher Robert Hamerling. Quote, "It is true that people can do what they will, but they cannot will what they will, because the will is determined by motives. They cannot will what they will." Let us examine these words more closely. Is the meaning they convey rational? Would free will thus consist of the ability to will something without motive or reason? But what does it mean to will if not to have a reason for one's preference to do or aspire to one thing rather than another? To will without cause or motive would mean to will without willing it. Motive, as a concept, is inseparably related to that of willing. Without a definite motive, the will is an empty capacity. Only motive makes it active and real. It is indeed correct to say that the human will is not free, insofar as its direction is always determined by the strongest motive. Close quote. Footnote: Die Atomistik des Willens, Beiträge zur Kritik der modernen Erkenntnis, Volume 2, The Atomistic Nature of the Will, Contributions to a Criticism of Modern Knowledge, Robert Hemmerling, 1830 to 1889. Born Rupert Hamerling, Austrian poet and schoolteacher. End of footnote. For every action that does not take place in the light of self-knowledge, the motive, the cause of the action, must be felt as a compulsion. It is a different matter when the cause falls within the bounds of self-knowledge. Thus, the cause becomes part of the self. The will is no longer determined, but determines itself. Conformity to the laws and motives of willing no longer dominate the one who wills. They are no different than the willing itself. To illuminate one's actions with the light of self-observation means to overcome all coercion of motives. In this way, the will places itself within the realm of freedom. Not all human actions are characterized by freedom. The only free actions are those inspired completely by self-observation. Because self-observation lifts the individual I to the universal I, free action arises from the universal I. The old question of whether the will of the human being is free or subordinated to a general unalterable necessity is not the real question. Actions performed by a person as an individual are not free. The only free actions are those performed by a person after spiritual rebirth. It is not a question of whether people in general are free or not free. They are both. They lack freedom before their rebirth, and they gain freedom through such a rebirth. Individually, the upward evolution of humanity involves transforming unfree willing into one that has the character of freedom. Those who have come to understand the principle behind their actions as being their own have overcome the compulsion of that lawful principle, and with this their own lack of freedom. Freedom is not a given fact of human existence, rather it is a goal. In free action, a person resolves a contradiction between the world and self. People's actions become the acts of universal existence. They have a sense of being in complete harmony with this universal existence. Every dissonance between self and other is seen as the result of a not quite awakened self. But it is the destiny of self that it finds contact with that universe only by first becoming separated from it. People would not be human if they could not be distinguished as individualities apart from everything else. But they would not be human in the highest sense if, as distinct I-beings, they did not raise out of themselves to the universal I. Above all, it is characteristic of human nature that it should overcome a contradiction that is intrinsic to it to begin with. People who limit spirit to intellectual logic may feel their blood chilled by the thought that things should experience spiritual rebirth. They compare a fresh living flower outside, in all the fullness of its colors, to a cold, pale, diagrammatic thought of that flower. They become especially uncomfortable at the idea that people who are motivated to act out of solitary self-knowledge are freer than those who are spontaneous and naive and act on immediate impulses and the fullness of their nature. To one who sees only the one-sided logical aspect, those who are submerged within appear to be a walking demonstration of concepts, a phantom, compared to those who remain within the natural individuality. One hears such arguments about the spiritual rebirth of things, indeed particularly among those equipped with healthy organs for sensory perception and with lively drives and passions, but whose capacity for observation falls short when faced with objects having a purely spiritual nature. Their perception fails the moment they are expected to perceive something that is purely spiritual. They deal only with the husks of concepts, if not empty words. Therefore, when the matter of spiritual significance arises, they maintain a dry, abstract intellect. But for those whose gift for observation in the purely spiritual realm is like that in the sensory realm, life does not inevitably become poorer as it is enriched with spiritual meaning. If I look at a flower, why should its rich colors lose even the smallest amount of freshness, if not only my eye sees the colors, but my inner sense also sees the spiritual nature of that flower? Why should my personal life become poorer, because I do not follow my passions and impulses in spiritual blindness, but instead illumine them with the light of a higher knowledge? The life reflected in spirit is not poorer, but fuller and richer. Addendum from 1923. Only those who see spirit only as a collection of concepts, abstracted from sensory perceptions, fear the impoverishment of soul through an ascent to spirit. People who lift themselves, those through spiritual vision, to a life that goes beyond the senses in terms of meaning and reality, are free of such fear. Sensory existence grows pale only through abstractions. Sensory existence appears in its true light for the first time through spiritual sight and loses nothing of its sensory richness. The end of the introduction.